Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hello, everyone. Good to be back. My name is Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion and have written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
Awesome. And we have two guests with us today. Our first guest is Mary Jane Rice. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. I'm happy to be here. I am an editor by day and a poet by night. I am author of Grace Like Water, which is a collection of New Testament poems. And I'm also secretary on the board of the Borman Lit Lab.
And then we also have with us today, Dallin Crump. Introduce yourself.
Hello, thanks for having me. I'm Dallin. I'm a data analyst by profession, and I'm just a consumer of media. So I enjoy TV, books, movies, and I like The Chosen. So I'm happy to talk about it today.
And as Dallin said, we're going to be talking about The Chosen today. It's a multiple season TV series about the life of Christ and his disciples. It was directed and co-written by Christian filmmaker Dallas Jenkins and supported partly by Angel Studios, which is a spinoff of VidAngel. Season 3 just wrapped up this week with the first two episodes and the last two episodes being released in theaters. It's kind of a phenomenon. You've probably heard of it. But first, we're going to do our best book segment where we each recommend one thing we're watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is a very short book called And All Eternity Shook by Jacob Bender. It's a short post-mission memoir about a young man who comes home from his mission to find out that his mom is in the final stages of dying from cancer. It's a pretty literary book, so it's not going to read like a straightforward narrative. It jumps around a lot in time. I think it does so pretty well, but it's definitely less straightforward than something you might be used to reading. But it really wrestles with what C.S. Lewis called the problem of petitionary prayer, right? Jesus says we should ask him for things and he will give them to us. And then sometimes we don't get them. And prayer is also supposed to be about accepting the Father's will. And so it wrestles with that as this missionary prays for the life of his mother and wrestles with what his mission meant. It's very good. It comes out in an ultimately good place, I think. It's an indie title. You can buy it on Amazon or other online bookstores. And that is And All Eternity Shook by Jacob Bender. Carl, what have you got for us today?
So I recently picked up the collected short stories of Arthur C. Clarke. Of all the classic science fiction authors, Arthur C. Clarke is the one that I think most speaks to my soul. It's very based in actual science, but his stuff is always so mystical in the sort of way that like any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic. It's one of his lodestones. And so I've just been going through and reading some of his short stories that are just so fun. One is called The Star, which is about a Jesuit who's on an interstellar expedition to go explore a particular nebula. When they get there and they're able to do their calculations and figure out what's going on, he concludes that it must have been the nebula, like the star that went supernova, that was the light shining above Bethlehem when Christ was born. And he has a real wrestle with faith because there was a civilization in this solar system that got wiped out by the supernova. And he's like, why, Lord, did you have to give these people to the flame so that your coming could be shown on Earth? And there's just so much really interesting stuff there. So I'm about 200 pages into the 1,000-page book, but he has such good short stories. So the collected short stories of Arthur Clarke, go pick one and see if it floats your boat.
Awesome. I'm excited. I have not read those, but that's the Jesuit story. Sounds like one I need to pick up for a paper I'm working on. So I got to check that out. Mary Jane, what have you got for us today?
I feel like I should have brought something to do with poetry, but I am not reading any poetry right now. I tend toward nonfiction, like biography and whatnot, but I'm always listening to podcasts. So the thing that I am finding interesting right now is Fair, the Latter-day Saint Faircast. it switches up from time to time who's the host. And right now they have Jennifer Roach, who is a Master of Divinity from the Seattle School of Theology. And she was an ordained pastor before converting to the church in 2019. She just does about 20 minutes. It's a series that goes along with the Come Follow Me study. Questions that your evangelical friends might have about the church that relate to that week's study. The thing that I like about this is that it's very much ecumenical. It's about mutual understanding and not about arguing or proving or getting to all that kind of stuff. So I highly recommend that. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, we had Jennifer on the podcast in the fall for our Midnight Mass episode. So she's a friend of the podcast. We love her work. I've been listening to those too, and they really are great, especially in light of The Chosen. So maybe we'll be bringing up some of the points she talks about in our discussion today. Dallin, what have you got for us?
I just have to say a quick ditto on Jennifer's podcast. She's doing a great job with that. But yeah, so back in 2017, I read a book called Amish Grace. And it's a book about the real events that took place on October 2nd of 2006 with the West Nickel Mines Amish school shooting in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Just recently, I finally got around to watching a movie of the same title, Amish Grace. It was released in 2010, originally aired on the Lifetime Network. And so it is based on the events of the book. They take a little more artistic license. The family depicted in the film didn't actually exist. It's still a good movie. And this event, this West Nickel Mines Amish school shooting, if you're not familiar with it, it's worth looking into. But President James E. Faust actually referenced this event in his April 2007 General Conference talk called The Healing Power of Forgiveness. So in a nutshell, a man entered a one-room Amish school, took 10 girls hostage, and ended up shooting them. Five of them lost their lives. The other five were hospitalized and at various degrees of recovery and are going to be dealing with the effects of that the rest of their lives. But the remarkable thing about this story is that the very same day that the shooting occurred, a few Amish men from the community went to the home of the widow of this shooter who took his own life, and also the shooter's parents, and offered them forgiveness and actually offered them support in the healing process and really rallied around his family, took care of his widow, his children. It's just a remarkable story of love and forgiveness, and I can't recommend it highly enough. I think there's a lot we can learn from our Amish brothers and sisters about forgiveness and about faith. It's a faith-promoting story. It can be difficult. There's nothing that's not family-friendly about the movie, but it does raise some difficult topics, and it can be pretty emotional, but it really is just a remarkable story and one that I really love.
I remember that story in the news very clearly when that happened. It was amazing.
That does sound like a really powerful story. I'm going to have to check it out when I'm in a stable emotional mood and can handle it. So we'll have links to all these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. And if you purchase one of these suggestions, buying through the links on our website helps support our podcast. We also wanted to do a quick shout out to a recent episode from one of our fellow Public Square Media podcasts. Sit Down with Sky and Preston is a podcast with the tagline, Defending Gospel Truths as Gay Latter-day Saints. I've been listening to some of their recent episodes, and I wanted to shout out the episode in October called Advice for New Missionaries, Gay or Straight. It was a really eye-opening episode for me as a straight Latter-day Saint. Some of the advice is general for all missionaries about being humble and how to conceptualize dealing with the troubles of mission life. And some of it was for challenges that are specific to gay missionaries, like being attracted to your companion. What do you do about that? How do you discuss it with your mission president? Just really fascinating stuff. And it's approached from a very faithful perspective of affirming the doctrines of the church. So that's season 2, episode 17. Their podcast is in the middle of changing hosts, so you might find it under Sit Down with Sky and Manda if they've updated. Anyway, they're one of our fellow Public Square Media podcasts, and I recommend that you check them out. And now on to our main discussion of The Chosen. My main question in approaching this is, why does The Chosen work? There are a lot of religious films and religious artwork out there. that is devotional that doesn't work well, that is cheesy or overwrought and just doesn't stand the test of time. And I feel like, although The Chosen is still really new, so we don't know how it's going to hold up over time, that The Chosen is something really different and unique. Dallin, I know you're a super fan of The Chosen. So how about you tell us what attracts you to The Chosen and why do you think it works?
Yeah, I'm okay with that, describing myself as a super fan.
You've watched it at least twice. So
I have watched the series through twice now. There's a lot to like about it. And there's some criticisms, which we'll get into later. I do, believe it or not, I have my own criticisms. And no series is going to be perfect that's produced by human beings, right? But what really works for me, now, I grew up watching media produced by our church, right? There's a lot of good media that I've seen that's helped me understand more about Jesus Christ, understand more about the gospel, strengthen my faith, and feel the Spirit. I think about videos that I watched in seminary, for example, and other media that the church has produced. The church has ventured out into kind of a more kind of fictionalized storytelling with the Testaments. If you remember the Testaments,
mm-hmm. It was legacy. Like
legacy. Right. And so there's a lot of good things. There's some cheesy moments, of course, in those, but there's a lot of good things to come out of those as well. So your faith promoting in the end and pointing to Christ. But what works with The Chosen as compared to, let's say, like the Bible videos that the church has produced or other videos is where those are more just a reenactment. This is more like it's a story. I feel like they do a really good job of telling a story. And they try to remain faithful to the biblical narrative and incorporate and weave the stories that we know so well from the New Testament. But then they fill it out with this additional storytelling. What may have happened surrounding the characters, surrounding the people that Jesus Christ chose to surround himself with. There's a lot of world building. There's a lot of character building. People's backstories come to life. And yeah, they may or may not have actually happened, but they work. For the most part, they work. And it's really interesting to see how they weave those backstories together and make these stories come to life. And that's really what it's done for me is it's made the characters seem more real to me, more relatable to me. And yes, I have to keep reminding myself, this is not in the New Testament. Could it have happened? Sure. But I have to be willing to say, okay, this probably didn't happen or at least happen this way. But more often than not, I find myself being like, that's really cool. I like how they did that. I like how they filled out this character's backstory and then worked it into this story that we know. So that's why it's engaging to me. I just love to just see what they've done with it and the direction they've taken with it. I feel like it's built my faith in Jesus Christ and really helped me to come to know him better.
The showrunner, Dallas Jenkins, I watched a couple of the videos about the sort of the making of stuff or his roundtables with biblical scholars. And he says he always wants it to be as close to the Bible as possible, but he wants it to all be plausible. That's the word he keeps using over and over in the DVD extras portions that you can find mostly on YouTube. Is this exactly what happened? No, we don't know. But is it plausible that Matthew was Peter's tax collector? Yeah, plausible. So why not? And then they throw that in there as an element of the show.
So many of the disciples knew each other in the beginning anyway, that it's not hard to find that plausible. So we were watching Groundhog Day the other day because it was, in fact, Groundhog Day. And we're reading up on the history of it a little bit, directed by Harold Ramis. When the writer of the screenplay, Danny Rubin, was first working with him, the movie was much more philosophical. And Ramis said to him, it can't be this philosophical. It has to be funny first. And the thing that I see about The Chosen is that even though it's chock full of doctrine and good meaty stuff, it is entertaining first. And I think that's why it works, is because the director worked really hard to make it entertaining. Part of that is the creating of the characters and the world building and all that. But I just think it's an amazing feat how they took in the New Testament. When you read it, it's just like miracle, 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 event, miracle, miracle. And they don't any of them string together. They're just like a compilation of things that happened.
It's like bullet points.
Yeah, they've somehow woven this all together so that you're like, oh, that's why that happened. And then you have to remind yourself, well, we don't know why it happened, but it fits so well that you can imagine that was the way that it happened. It's really quite well constructed. The narrative arc is just great.
I agree. Yeah. The thing that came to me as I was probably like halfway through season two is that it feels like when you're watching or reading a fairy tale retelling, where we know that there's these bullet points in Cinderella that have to happen. She's got to be missing a slipper, and she's got to have a ball and run away and midnight and all these important plot points. And so it's treating the Bible like that. Okay, we need to have Peter pulling in a bunch of fish, and we need to have the Sermon on the Mount, and we need to have these two are brothers, and Matthew's a tax collector. And then how can we string those things together so that when we reach set points that are in the Bible, they become extra meaningful? Like, you never really think about what does it mean that Jesus tells Peter to cast his net in on the right side and he's going to pull in all these fish. It's a miracle, but you don't think about what it means. But in this show, you build up for 8 episodes. And then when that happens, you know why it's so amazing and why he's immediately willing to follow the Savior.
Why it's important to him and why he says, I'm a sinful man. This fairy tale analogy is like if you see an adaptation of a favorite book, right? Mm-hmm. Pride and Prejudice for me. I have to watch every adaptation. I get a sense of satisfaction from seeing them do it well. And so this is that same sense of satisfaction from seeing things that I've already read put into real life and done well.
To go with your Cinderella analogy, I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Ever After with Drew Barrymore. So that's what came to mind when you mentioned that. I was like, that's so true. Ever After is this adaptation of the Cinderella story, but what if it actually happened in real life and how would that look? And yeah, they have Leonardo da Vinci in there for some reason and other things that may or may not have actually been plausible, but it makes you see a familiar story in a completely different light. It adds light and it adds context. And when I say context, I'm learning more about ancient Jewish and Roman culture from this series than I have ever known or been interested in before. And they've really done their homework depicting Romans, depicting Jews, how they lived together or not together, separately from each other, what the dynamic was between those cultures. I'm learning all kinds of things about the context and just the setting in which these stories took place. And it's just filling them out for me in a wonderful way.
Yeah, that to me is the thing that stands out the most, is this is simply good television. The characters are all three-dimensional. Their interactions with each other are plausible given the situations that they are in and the culture of the time and the background and the politics and everything. Like, amazingly, one of my sort of characters that is growing on me is Rabbi Shmuel, who is like antagonist towards Jesus through a lot of it, but he's coming around, at least by the end of season three. Don't know where that's going to go for the rest of the thing, but he seems plausible to me. Like, there'd be this rabbi who has these issues with Jesus, who's claiming these titles and these doing these preaching and things and messing up the established order.
He feels like someone you know in your ward, right? Like, we all know a religious person like this, and we can sympathize.
But I like that when he goes then to his leaders and his superiors in the Pharisaical order, that he gets caught up in the politics of what's going on among the different sects of the Pharisees, and he doesn't like it. It's just really interesting to me to see him be a full-blown character. And I just would like to give a shout-out to the season 2 episode where the title is just Matthew 4:24, which is just a really brief scripture that just says lots of people came to Jesus and he healed them. But it's a beautifully crafted episode where the opening shot is like a 15-minute Steadicam shot that's one continuous take. Like, that stuff is hard to do, and it just gives you such a sense of all these characters and the flow of things and how the situation's working out. And then as it's just one of those episodes where they just talk to each other. There's not really any action. All the action is happening off screen as this huge line of people is slowly coming to Jesus and he is healing every single one of them while everybody else is hanging out in the camp just talking. And as it advances and as the sun sets and as things go on, they get a little more heated and they start getting a little more angry at each other. And right as they're about to have this huge blow up fight, Jesus comes into the camp absolutely, utterly exhausted from healing these hundreds and hundreds of people and just says, "Good night, everyone. I'm going to bed." And then he crawls into bed and his mom comes and like helps him take his shoes off. He says like the Jewish prayer to go to sleep. And everybody kind of is like, "Oh, I'm sorry, we were about to start fighting." But it all worked so beautifully. So it's just good television. Aside from the fact that it is the Bible, they're just making things and people and stories and show arcs that are interesting to watch. And that makes it good television.
I think one of the most interesting things about the show is the way that they've done Jesus. Portraying Jesus is difficult. You want to make him very solemn and stick with the scriptural language because you don't want to have to make up words for Jesus.
Literally, in the case of our Bible videos, Jesus does not speak any dialogue that isn't explicitly stated in the King James Bible.
And that's a thing that's useful, right? It's useful, and like Dallin said, it's an illustration of the scriptures more than it is entertainment or a narrative of any kind.
A teaching tool.
Yeah, it's a teaching tool, and there's use for that. I think another one of the ways the fairy tale retelling analogy works is that when you only have one adaptation, like the Harry Potter movies or whatever, you get annoyed at everything they get wrong. Every time they get something wrong, you're like, "Ah, oh, I wish they'd done that better." But if you've got something like Pride and Prejudice, where there's 5, 6, 7 adaptations, then you like compare, contrast. "Oh, I like Darcy in this one, but I like this scene in this one." And you can pick and choose. And I feel like if we had only The Chosen, then we'd be a lot more picky about, "Oh, there's all these extra biblical things and it's not necessarily the accurate Jesus or whatever." But because we have lots of different versions of Bible stories, we can let that go a little bit as long as we don't let it replace the scriptures. The way they portray Jesus is really interesting. I was rereading, as we were getting ready for this episode, an essay by Connor Hilton, who we had on our Under the Banner of Heaven podcast, called "Jesus, Where's the Joy?" from Mormonism and the Movies, which is a great book you guys should check out. But he talks about different depictions of Jesus in film and how almost universally Jesus is very solemn and as a result boring as a character, because like he's allowed to get angry when he drives people out of the temple, and that's about the only emotion he's allowed to display. And The Chosen really manages to walk that line of letting Jesus tease people and getting across a little bit of the sass that you can see sometimes in the biblical text, like giving people nicknames. This was a thing Jesus did. So it just is amazing as a work of art that he's managed to walk that line where he still can give the Sermon on the Mount very earnestly and yet also be a human being, which is, I think, something we miss in a lot of our Jesus films and artwork, is that humanity. We get the God aspect pretty well.
And I think this is one thing that it has helped me appreciate more is, right, the traditional Christians have the phrase that Jesus was fully God and fully man. He has two separate essences and they are combined in him in a unique way, which doesn't become a third thing. It's just, it's these two different things, but they're combined in this unique way in the person of Jesus. And I have a stronger sense of incarnation from having watched this than anything else I have encountered. And I think it particularly comes out in his relationship with his mother. Like the line, "Woman, what do you want me to do? My time is not yet." That's there in the Bible, and it never occurred to me to really read between the lines there, because he says, "Mom, not yet," and then he goes and does the miracle anyway. And it just humanized that little moment between Jesus and Mother Mary in a way that I thought was perfectly in line with the biblical text. But the subtext had to be presented on the screen, and it just makes the thing become so much more real to me.
She offers the line, "If not now, when?" And so that's not in the Bible, but you can imagine a mother saying that to her child. You can imagine Mary saying that to Jesus.
Well, it was a callback to when Jesus said it to her when he was teaching in the temple. And she's like, "No, it's not time for this yet." And he being young says, if not now, when? I think it's interesting that same line can have different answers at the different times that they say it. And they repeat it several times. Not everything comes with a simple answer.
Yeah, and that's another aspect. The title of the show is The Chosen. And I feel like that's another way the show succeeds is by focusing on the disciples, on Jesus's chosen. Because a lot of season one is the story of Simon and Matthew. And it's not really so much the story of Jesus until a little later.
Chosen means the disciples, but it also means Jesus. And it also means the Jewish people. And it also means everyone who comes to him. It's such a great title.
It is. But I like that they've humanized the disciples. My friend was saying to me today that like she can finally tell the apostles apart after watching The Chosen. Like, they all know who Peter is, but like after that, like they all blend together when you're reading the New Testament and not really paying attention. But when you see them in the show and they have storylines, you can be like, oh, I know who Nathaniel is. He's the one who always says what comes to his mind and probably shouldn't.
Simon the Zealot.
Simon the Zealot, right? And you understand why, what that means and what that signifies. It's great. I love it.
It is great. All the characters are very well drawn. My favorite one, which is probably a lot of people's favorite one, is Matthew. He is very childlike in his trust and straightforwardness, forthrightness, and you get frustrated by him, but you like him as well.
Yeah, and he's clearly portrayed, and I think this was a bold choice on the showrunner's part, as clearly being on the autism spectrum. The actor does a marvelous job, reminiscent of Leonardo DiCaprio way back in Who's Eating Gilbert Grape, which is just such an interesting choice. And I like your thought there, Liz, that it is emphasizing the people. All the individual episodes seem really well-crafted, as well as the show as a whole. But that first episode, Mary Magdalene is the main character. And the Savior doesn't even show up until the last 4 minutes of the episode. It's like a 55-minute long episode. And all these people are running around. You're like, okay, I know who that is. 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 And it's not until he shows up in the bar, which maybe is anachronistic, but we'll give him that. And she's about to keep drinking because of this assault that's happened to her and the possession that she's had. And even the great Nicodemus, Jewish rabbi, can't cast out of her. And his first line is, that's not for you. And then it turns into this great thing where it's the scripture she's quoted the whole episode since the beginning that he says to her, and it's very different coming from the first person Lord of the universe, but he's not there till the last 4 or 5 minutes. And that is a good metaphor for, I think, the show as a whole. This isn't a show about Jesus in some important ways, and that makes it better. Maybe that's slightly blasphemous to say, but it helps round out the rest of the characters and make the whole thing about the early church, which is really interesting.
And that's the way the New Testament is. It's not written by Jesus. It's everybody around him that talks about him and what he did. And you get the four different gospels with their different takes. And yeah, so if that fits right in with the way everything is, how people react to Jesus.
It's a relational gospel, talking about how he changes people and how they change because of him and choosing to follow him.
Whether it's hardening in their set ways they already have or changing, he's like a chemical agent that comes in and affects things.
Speaking of Matthew, I think he's got some of the best stuff, especially in season three. But like that reconciliation between Matthew and his father is probably one of the best reconciliations I've seen. And I feel like it's one that's really needed for nowadays. Our culture has this thing where it's totally normal and acceptable and considered healthy to cut family members off and just not speak to them and to give people up. And The Chosen has just clearly demonstrated how painful that is on both sides and that it's not helpful. And how Christ wants to heal that relationship. So like that episode was really touching for me. Are there any other moments that stood out to you guys?
I just want to comment on that. I think that was a great moment too, that it showed that in the relationship, it wasn't one more than the other that was responsible for the breach. They both did things and behaved in ways they needed to repent of, and they both changed when they came back together.
I agree. Matthew is a favorite character, and I love how they use his unfamiliarity with his own culture to teach us about it. Mm-hmm. So as he is learning about, because presumably, at least in this backstory that they've concocted for him, he skipped out of the traditional school that he would have attended with his peers so that he could learn how to be a tax collector, right? So he's not familiar with the scriptures. He's not familiar with his own faith, his own culture. So he's learning about it. And as he learns about it, we learn about it with him. And I love how they've done that. But you asked about just a favorite moment. There's so many, really, that there are just so many. I think just about every episode, there's like just a scene or a moment that is pivotal or that the episode revolves around. And I just like how they do that. I really like in season 2, episode 2, the story of Nathaniel, right? So this architect, he's working on this big project. There's a big accident and he's thrown off of the project. His dreams are shattered and he's wrecked. He is devastated. All of this he wanted to do to glorify God, and it ended up completely wrong and opposite of what he wanted and what he expected. And he doesn't know what to do with himself. Just that tender scene when he meets the Savior for the first time, and his faith is such that just he immediately, as Jesus says, that he saw him sitting under that tree. And that was a powerful moment for me. Just it really got to me. And just also just Nathaniel's faith, how almost immediately he's like, "You're the one, aren't you?" Because only the Messiah could have known how in the depths of despair he was, and but also letting him know that he was not alone, that Jesus was aware of him and his situation. So I just love that.
Isn't it interesting, though, that multiple characters go through these kind of in the depths of despair moments, but the release, the healing does not come when they hit rock bottom. It comes much later, both with Nathaniel, with Peter, and just different things where they're allowed to sit there for a while and work through it and think about it on their own. The healing and the relief comes at an unexpected moment. Something about the Nathaniel story, though, I didn't realize before. The director had gone to Hollywood, wanted to make it big there, like Nathaniel, right? He felt like he was called to do this kind of thing. He got put in charge of a project, and it just failed miserably to the point where he didn't think he'd ever be able to get anything again. And so it was at that point that he switched directions and started to work on this donation supported life story of Jesus. And I thought, I just wonder how much of personal experience is woven into these stories, like with Eden's miscarriage, how many people in the cast or helping with the writing or directing might have personal experience with that, and how that might have molded the way the stories went.
Yeah. Oh, that plot line with Eden is wonderful. And I love the resolution in the final episode with the mikvah and how, again, brilliant incorporation of Jewish culture. I know they had a messianic Jewish rabbi who's a consultant with them and helps them get the culture right. And just that, I love that they pulled her story in, and they're so good at pulling in stories of women, which can be hard to find in the scriptures, but they do it without really inventing anyone of whole cloth, but just like amplifying what's already there and making it more noticeable. And it feels so natural. I just have really enjoyed the way they've dealt with the prevalence of men in the scriptures and gotten some good female characters in there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That goes to one of my favorite arcs, which is the woman with the issue of blood, which they absolutely leaned into what that is.
Over and over again.
We gloss over that a lot because we're like, ew, yuck, feminine hygiene issues. They did not shy away from that. And but even in one of those episodes where they had the reading of the Torah about the people with the issue need to be unclean until the evening, even just having that moment of reading the Torah so you could understand what restrictions she would have been operating under because of the ritual purity laws at the time and how they handled those things. I thought that actress played that part marvelously to show the despair of having lived for so long as basically a societal outcast because of this thing that she had no control over, and the happiness that she exhibited upon being healed and then going and doing her purification in the Sea of Galilee, while Eden's there watching this whole thing going, oh, why not me? And so there's a bit of a heart-wrenching sort of moment there. But I completely agree, Liz, with your assessment. They do a good job of bringing the women's stories in, but it doesn't feel like forced diversity that sometimes you get from the other TV shows who are like, oh, I got to make sure that we have a couple of these people and some ethnically ambiguous people here just so we can make sure we're covering all our bases. And I feel like this show just does it organically and it absolutely works.
So I agree with that, but I will say in this respect, I thought it was a little bit too pat that Mary Magdalene just happened to have two friends, one that was lame and one that was blind, and that they were right there so that they could represent the types of healings that Jesus was doing. I understand that by having those characters, it really personalized it and you could really get into it. But it's like sometimes it feels like the characters are being put there as a placeholder for this type of person and a placeholder for this type of person. I have nothing wrong. Like, it is a very diverse cast and it just fits so well with the storyline. It's like very natural to see people of all different ethnicities and backgrounds in the story. But when it feels like, okay, now we have to have this kind of person because we need blind people to be healed, and this kind of, that felt a little clunky. But
yeah, those two particular characters, I agree with you on that one. I feel like the theme of this season three that just ended is the miracles. There were a lot of healing and miracles, and that the overall question is, number one, are we brave enough to ask Jesus for what we need? And then number two, do we continue to follow Jesus even if we don't get the miracle that we want? Like, we see that with Simon and with his wife, but we also see that with little James, right? That he's concerned that he's inadequate and he's afraid to ask Jesus to heal him. And in the end, Jesus doesn't heal him. He still has this limp, and there's this discussion that forefronts the idea that the gospel does not exist to fix our lives. Like, your life is not going to be perfect if you follow Jesus, which is something this show definitely could have fallen into. Like, ta-da, everybody follows Jesus and their life is great now, which would not be true, which would make it ring false. And I think by fronting that in this season with little James and then with the overall arc of Simon's struggle with why his wife was not healed and why he wasn't there when she was going through this struggle, really forefronts that concern that the gospel is not a prosperity gospel. It's not a follow Jesus and your life is great. Your life is still hard and tough things still happen.
But it seems like Mary Magdalene delivers a lot of those philosophical lines throughout the series. Like, she's just on point most of the time. And I like her character a lot because she was the first, right? She was the first one to be chosen, at least in the series. Mm-hmm. And so she's always there and an example to the others in some respects.
And then the other thing that came to mind for me was like, that you can cure a disease, but there's no cure for life because you're going to have to still be alive and work your way through it. So the best thing that you can give in life is a foundation and somebody to lean on and somebody to turn to, because you're never going to be able to fix everything.
Apparently, that conversation with little James went super viral when they put it up on The Chosen's Facebook page. And I love it because that is in some ways a metaphor for all of us, because as they said in one of their biblical scholar roundtables, the kingdom of God is already and also not yet. Like, it's here, but the full consummation where God wipes away all of our tears is not for thousands of years in the future for these people, maybe for us, I don't know. No man knows the hour. And so that conversation with little James is a metaphor for all of our lives, just that not everything's going to go according to plan. And yet we should still rejoice in the gospel and in the Savior's atoning power and his healing ability and the grace that he gives us, even if we are all still works in progress, whether that's a limp in little James's case or just our sinful natures in everybody else's as well.
Or like Mary Magdalene, right? She's really upset when she falls back on her old habits and her old ways. And that's going to happen to us. And I like that they had that happen even to the people who literally have Jesus next to them. You would think that would prevent you from falling back into your bad habits, but they're still people and they still will.
And that brings up the elephant in the room, which is what's going to happen with Judas?
We got to talk about Judas.
I made a note of this, that there's a lot of different representations of Judas and why he does what he does, all across the spectrum, how they present him. But they have chosen to present Judas as an honest, good person. It's very relatable and sympathetic. So the question to me is, what is it going to be that causes him to betray Jesus? Is he going to have a change of heart? Is it going to be a motivation for some other reason? James Goldberg wrote The Five Books of Jesus. I don't know if anyone else has read that, but I thought it had a unique twist in that Judas had this, what he thought was a good motivation to try to force Jesus to get on the ball and reveal himself as the Messiah and usher in the kingdom of God on earth right then, because he was suffering from a lot of emotional pain himself. So that made Judas a sympathetic character with a relatable motivation, but you can still clearly see that what he did was wrong. And I'm just interested, what do we think is going to happen with this Judas? Does anybody have any guesses?
Oh man, I really enjoy this Judas character, which scares me to death. I really like him. And so it's going to be so sad. I think they're leaning hard on possibly like the businessy side of Judas. Judas is involved in some kind of shady land transactions and then decides to go follow Jesus. And then he does some marketing for the Sermon on the Mount and like figures out how to sell it. And I'm wondering if they're going to maybe go that he's going this businessy, like you're building this great empire of cult of personality kind of aspect. I wonder if he's going to go off in that direction.
And he could. It's just hard to understand how that equates to selling your rabbi for 30 pieces of silver. What was he trying to accomplish there? Did he feel betrayed himself?
They're holding their cards really close to the vest with Judas right now. So it could be anything. I guess my prediction would be maybe there's some kind of falling out between him and Jesus or him and the rest of the group. And so during that separation, he's reverts to his old conniving ways. That's my prediction anyway.
He wasn't too terribly conniving before, though. He always seemed to be objecting to the conniving ways of his friend. I think it's interesting how they're setting things up. So when you read the Gospels, if they ever talk about Judas, it's always, yeah, he did this because he was greedy. He kept the bag because he was only interested in money. They have a retroactive reinterpreting of these things. And you can see them building this into the story along the way. You know that the disciples are going to hate Judas and that they will look at all this stuff and say it was his idea. But it's nice to see from this end.
The fact that we're having this discussion showcases, I think, one of the great strengths of this show. And I fully intend this pun here. They clearly have some kind of show Bible. And that is to their credit that this is an absolute act of faith. They're like, we're going to take, I think it's 7 seasons. They have the 7 seasons all planned out, and they are not compromising on the pacing or the scale or anything else. Like, they're going to bring Judas in, and they have a plan for what to do to flesh out this fairly one-dimensional character from the Gospels, because they're going to do it over the next 4 seasons. And that's marvelous that they can just take the time to really get us into these characters and get it right. and that they have an overarching plan that I'm sure as they write individual scripts and things will be changed and tweaked. But TV shows that say, here is my 5 or 6 season arc, this is what I want to do with it, I find always better than TV shows that just kind of, well, here's season 1, and if we get renewed, I guess maybe we'll do something like this. Then they have no plans beyond that at all. They fizzle out.
We can name names here, but we won't.
Yeah, yep.
Oh, names. We're talking about Lost.
Battlestar Galactica.
Heroes also. Anyway. Yeah. The advantage to doing a series based on the New Testament is you know where you're going. It's got an end, and it keeps you focused. They're able to branch out into these other subplots, but they're all going to be drawn back in at the end.
They have scaffolding to work with.
So one scene that I really loved that really hit me hard was in episode 7, the storyline with Matthew and the prayer tassels, when he finally decides to wear them. And we've got a couple of other things in that same episode talking about someone who disregards them and doesn't wear them and what they mean and their significance. And he finally puts on these prayer tassels that he's gotten from this old man who sacrificed himself for his family, which is very interesting that they got this atonement theory in there. That was a pretty sly thing they did. Anyway, but Matthew puts on these prayer tassels and I was like, oh, that's so meaningful. Man, I wish I had something to wear that helped me remember my religion. And then I was like, Liz, you're an idiot. You do. But we take it for granted. And so having Matthew be the newbie, relearning about this and re-accepting himself into his tradition, like, really renewed that for me. That reminded me and made my wearing of the garment more meaningful to me just watching this show. And I don't think that was intended, but that meant something to me as a Latter-day Saint. Mary Jane, we wanted to get to you because you've been writing poetry from the Come Follow Me lessons, and you've got this book of all of your poems from the New Testament. And I thought you could talk a little bit about the process of being creative from the scriptures. It seems very difficult to me. I've been listening to your podcast with your poems, and it's interesting to hear you talk about how your process of writing from your scripture reading.
So originally it was just meant to enhance my scripture study, right? I'm already a poet, and one of the ways that I engage with words and things that I'm reading is that I start like rearranging the ideas into poetry. And so I'd set the goal of writing a poem every week to go along with the lesson. It didn't have to be the biggest theme. It didn't have to be the most important theme, just anything. Because one of the interesting things about creativity is you cannot set rules for how it will work. And that's one of the things that I find really interesting about The Chosen is that when the church put together its Bible videos, it set very strict rules for what Jesus could say and how and when. And that works really well as a teaching aid or a passion play or miracle play type format, but it doesn't work very well for creativity. You can't set the rules up quite that strictly. You have to say, okay, I'm allowed to play with Jesus's words, and I'm allowed to imagine a new story from somebody else's point of view. So that's what I started doing, was like, if a character was interesting to me, I would change it or make something up that seemed like it was plausible, like we were talking about earlier. Seems plausible that it could have fit. But the hardest thing, of course, is what if you are going to be putting words in Jesus's mouth? That seems sacrilegious almost. But we can see from The Chosen how you can do it really subtly and carefully and respectfully and make it plausible and use the themes of the doctrine that you already know he taught and come with something beautiful that helps people see the doctrine in a new way. But as you mentioned before, I didn't often just come from Jesus's point of view. That's really, really hard. So I would be tangential, talk about people around him. But there is one where I did put some quotes in his mouth, and it's the right after the feeding of the 5,000, when some of the disciples leave off from following Jesus, they have that confrontation with the difficult doctrine. And he asks his disciples, will you also go away? The poem's called Peter. I don't know if you mind if I read a poem from here?
Go for it.
Hey, all right. I'll just read this one because it's an example of having the Lord say some things in this poem. There's two voices here. There's Jesus and there's Peter. So it may be difficult to hear the going back and forth, but I will try to read slowly. Peter, will you also go away? He was always asking difficult questions. When your belly is satisfied, what bread will you crave? In the kingdom of heaven, where no one goes hungry, will you forget to eat? I was empty all my life, the pit of me always hollow, whatever my nets hauled in, until he came with his hard sayings. Course after course, I chewed, swallowed, digested. Now meals seem scraps, eating a fast. Surely he sees how he fattens my bones, flows through my veins like milk and honey. When you are all my living, where else can I go? So that's just a short poetic reimagining of that conversation where Peter's like, where am I going to go? There's nobody else who has the words of life. I think it's possible to let your creativity flow first, just test it out. And then after you've got your drafts down, that's where the editing comes in and you can pull it back. If maybe you've gone too far, then there's no reason why you can't pull it back. And I'm sure that they have done drafts and drafts for The Chosen and worked on these conversations and, of course, consulted with people of different views to see what will work the best. I just think that, as I said at the top of the show, if it's not entertaining, then you've already lost the battle. So when it comes to writing creatively about anything, including religion, then you have to do it artfully first and then make sure that the content goes along with that artfulness. It's not good just to be artful. You have to have meaning in there, but it has to be something that people can enjoy or they won't listen. That the parables were a good example of this. I think Jesus was an awesome storyteller and he really drew people in. So he knew all about being creative and matching that with the truths that you have to teach.
It's one of the taglines for our podcast, to help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful.
Which brings up how, like, watching The Chosen, I binged all three seasons at once over a few weeks. And I got so that, like, I was walking around the house thinking, oh, should I be doing this? How would Jesus feel about this? And imagining it that was the Jesus of The Chosen and having to remind myself, that's not really Jesus, so I don't need to worry about doing it the way he would have approved. But same thing with poetry or whatever. You can take in other people's viewpoints and not think that it has to be either right or wrong. It's just a viewpoint. That's all it is.
So I wanted to get back to the one interesting thing that we have to talk about on a Latter-day Saint podcast about The Chosen is the whole controversy over, is The Chosen secretly sneaking Mormon doctrine into all its evangelical watchers? If you haven't been following the news, there was a big controversy about this line that Jesus says, I am the law, which was awesome when he delivered it, but is not in the Bible, but is almost in the Book of Mormon, like a sort of line of it is in the Book of Mormon. And so there was a huge controversy, especially given that a good amount of the backing for the show comes from VidAngel, which is a Mormon-run company.
That the church let them use their Jerusalem
set for
most of season two and chunks of other stuff.
Yeah. And so it's very interesting to me to see this reaction from the evangelical community to this, like, one line, literally one line in the whole show, and just super worried about it. And as I was watching it and binging it over these few weeks, because I had not been watching it before, I was interested to see that there's a lot of evangelical doctrine in there where they dodge around things that we as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints think are important that are in the Bible. And they've dodged around it because those doctrines are less emphasized in the evangelical faith. They didn't show some, go ahead, Carl.
Well, because this is my wheelhouse, right? Like, I have a PhD in theology, and I did work in biblical studies in my master's program and learned to read Greek and everything. I think what they did is avoided things that would be controversial. Are you going to show Jesus's baptism? Is it going to be a sprinkling? Is it going to be like when the greatest story on earth, when Charlton Heston is playing John the Baptist, like Jesus goes into the river and kind of kneels down and goes under the water as John the Baptist pours water down on him. I feel like they're trying to split the difference because I don't think that's a form of the ritual that has ever existed in any particular denomination. They're trying to have all their cake and eat it too. And so I think the Chosen tried just to avoid some of these controversial things, which turned out to make it evangelical. And I apologize to my evangelical brothers and sisters here, but as someone who resonates very much with the Catholic tradition, even though I am a full believing Latter-day Saint, if you cut out all the controversial stuff, it turns out what you end up with inadvertently is a very evangelical Jesus. So they're getting mad that we're sneaking Latter-day Saint stuff in. That whole conversation when Jesus says, I'm going to send you out two by two. And one of the apostles, I forget which one, is, wait, you're giving us authority? Did I miss a ritual? And I was thinking, yes, you have. You absolutely have missed the ritual. And it's such a staggeringly ignorant charge to make that we're sneaking Mormonism into the Chosen so that we can trick the evangelicals. No, but sorry, this is the last point. Even if you go to the Chosen app, they're all like all the sort of extras, like the DVD extras sort of version through this app. And there is one about the different people that they consulted and the different ways and things. The thumbnail for that says a couple of questions. One of the questions is Dallas Jenkins a Mormon? I'm sitting there like, well, they know how to get their clicks or whatever.
Where to push the controversy button, yes.
Yep. And I just think it's such an interesting controversy to have come up. And that would be my one complaint about the show, is I almost feel like I would respect them a little bit more. And I hope my love for the show is obvious from what we've talked about so far and the things that I've said. But I almost feel like I would like it a little bit more if they had a little more of the courage of their convictions and didn't try to avoid some of this controversial stuff. It's all right. You can pick a form of baptism. I'm not going to be offended. I'm going to recognize that you made a choice, and I might disagree with that choice, but at least you would have not skipped that part.
I'm going to say, on the other hand, though, I feel like it's a fine line to walk, and them choosing to not show Jesus's baptism probably contributes to the show's success, because it's not something that people have to fixate on. They know he was baptized by John the Baptist, or John the Baptizer, as they call him in the series.
And it is mentioned offhandedly.
Yeah. Jesus himself mentions that he was baptized by John the Baptist. And so they do confirm that, at least after the fact. But keep in mind, I feel like the showrunners really are trying to include all Christian denominations and people who don't believe in Jesus Christ. They really are trying to make something that can appeal to everyone. And I feel like they're doing a really good job of it. And also just everyone who participates, the actor who plays Jesus, Jonathan Romey, is a Catholic, okay? And a devout Catholic. And there's members of our church that understand they're involved in the production. And so it's not just an evangelical effort. It really is a Christian effort. And I feel like they really are trying to do the best job that they can of appealing to everyone and not creating controversy from it. They don't want to create controversy over it. They want to draw people to Christ. And I feel like they're doing a pretty good job of it.
On the one hand, I totally understand their sensitivity about it, because I don't want people to say, oh, you're not a very good Mormon because you said this or you did that. And if we made a similar kind of entertainment, there would definitely be a Latter-day Saint flavor to it.
Can I give an example? The Living Scriptures, they've marketed the New Testament ones right to evangelicals. They had to redo the crucifixion one because originally it had the nail in the palm and in the wrist, and had to cut it because that is a Mormon thing.
I just couldn't figure out why it was such controversy, because even though it doesn't say in the Bible, I am the law, Jesus says a lot of things in this show that are not in the Bible. And it seems like a pretty standard Christian interpretation of Jesus. Is it not something people say, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law, that he gave the law, that he's... I don't know why they would object to that, because you know what else is in the Book of Mormon is Jesus Christ, and they also believe in Jesus Christ, and almost like saying, we're going to complain about this because we think it came from the Mormons rather than judging it for what it was, right?
So, and that reminds me of, you brought up Jennifer Roach's podcast for Fair, where she talks about how important getting Jesus right is to evangelicals. And so I wonder if it's more about that, is that they're very worried that they're going to end up with a Mormon interpretation of Jesus that is not correct.
And in one of the episodes, she mentioned that they frequently feel like Latter-day Saints are trying to trick them into believing something that's in the Book of Mormon. And so they're a little cagey about that. But, and I understand, sometimes I have suspicions about other people's motivations for why they're talking to me in a certain way. They start asking me questions, my mind immediately goes to, are they trying to manipulate me into a hard place I can't get out of? So I totally empathize with them. I just thought this was a funny thing to take issue with, because they believe it. And everybody liked the line because they believe it. So,
and it worked so well dramatically in that scene. That was a really epic scene. And it makes that phrase that a prophet is not accepted in his own country really come to life when his own synagogue almost stones him to death.
Yeah. I would agree 100% with your assessment, Dallin. I've been a little negative in saying they're trying to avoid the controversial stuff. But one thing, having watched now a lot, and I mentioned this several times, the DVD extras with Dallas, and the especially the ones with his biblical scholar consultants, because that's my wheelhouse that I really have enjoyed. He really is trying to make it Jesus for everybody. And I can 100% get behind that.
It's hard for us because we know there's more, right? We know there's so much more.
And it's interesting to me that there's a sense of melancholy fatality about this whole thing, the whole controversy with Latter-day Saints, because they're trying so hard to make it Jesus for everybody. And then at the same time, this one particular group that is heavily involved in its production goes after us.
We don't want any of your Jesus.
Yeah, we don't want any of your Jesus, and we're not sure that we want you around, is once again the subtext. And I think those two things are maybe a little more at odds with each other than they should be, but that is sort of a conversation for our evangelical friends to have among themselves. I am glad that this show is bringing more people to Jesus, because that's always a good thing, and I don't know, like it's doing real good work.
Yeah, considering the discussion in that final episode when the different groups from the Decapolis meeting together and their argument with each other, it just seems like an ironic thing. I will go with the best interpretation, which is that it's not very many people who are being this hardline about it. And the director's trying very hard to be careful.
Dallas Jenkins is doing some really good work here, and he is to be commended, especially again for trying, just launching into a 7-season project with having no idea how you were going to make it. That is an act of sheer faith that I have a lot of holy envy for.
It takes a lot of endurance to do a multi-year project like that, as I well know, because I wrote a poem a week for 4 years, and it does, it's an act of faith to say there's going to be something to show for this at the end of the 4 years. They are doing the same kind of thing, only on a much grander scale.
Considering it started with a crowdfunding campaign and we've wrapped up the 3rd season now, it's miraculous, really, that it's continued as long as it has.
That it made $8 million last weekend.
Wow.
We're going to close out our discussion. We could talk for a while, but we'll end with our ratings. I think this should go pretty quick. We do 3 different ratings. Our first rating is for content, clean versus objectionable material. And we rate on a scale of celestial, terrestrial, telestial, and outer darkness. I don't think there's a lot of objectionable material in the show, except for the one episode where they do show the miscarriage pretty graphically. I'd be hesitant to have younger kids in the room for that specific scene. And there is a warning on the screen that tells you it is coming.
There are a couple of scenes with people possessed by devils. There is a little bit of blood. But as far as if I were to compare this series to just about any other TV series out there, it's totally family friendly, right? Maybe for young kids, some scenes might be a little scary, but for the most part, this is something you can watch with your family.
Yeah.
The most you could say is that there's intensity because I didn't see any sex, no drugs, no violence. There's a little bit of drunkenness is all. It's amazing that it can be so clean and still come off as realistic.
100%. So yeah, I would give it celestial. The stuff that is objectionable is just realistic stuff, like having an issue of blood or having a miscarriage.
Frankly, I think children, they might be scared of some things like the devil possessions or something, but the women's issue of blood, that type of thing, menstrual cycles could go right over their head.
Yeah.
True.
Sure.
True.
I would
and
also...
If they're old enough that it doesn't go over their head, then you get to have a talk with them.
Yeah.
Which you should. So I agree. Celestial is where we're going on that. Our next rating is artistic merit on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls. I feel like this has great production values, especially for something that doesn't have a big studio behind it. I'd give it 5 popcorn balls. There's a few moments of anachronistic things that kind of bothered me. Like they make a joke about vegetables that are corny. And I'm like, pretty sure no corn in the Middle East at this time. So you can't make that joke.
I'm a fan of dad jokes, so I give that one a pass.
Yeah. I mean, it's like totally minor. But like that was one moment where I was like hit out of the show. I was like, no, there's no corn, guys.
A 21st century joke in a show set in the first century. And
you've got the pawn shop. I don't know if there's like official pawn shops going on.
The fact that there are bars, that's completely anachronistic. They would not have had something like that. They even mentioned that in one of the biblical scholar roundtables. All three of the biblical scholars are like, yeah, that's not a thing.
No, restaurants, bars, that's a new thing.
Yeah, right.
My favorite anachronism is always everybody's perfectly straight white teeth.
Yep.
That's an actor thing, though. I think myself, I would give the overall show a 4.5 popcorn balls. But for this season, 3.5, just because it seemed to me that it began to lose a little focus with a lot of different storylines branching out. But I think that'll probably come back together in the last seasons.
Yeah.
5 popcorn balls for me.
I'm going to give it 5 popcorn balls. I like it. I think they're doing a tremendous job. The directing, the writing, cinematography, considering the budget they started with and everything, they've just managed to pull something great together, and it's fun to watch.
Yeah. I also will say the one thing maybe that made for this season being the 3.5 is I really don't like overly weepy shows, because for me, it feels like it's a little emotionally manipulative, like the end of The Lord of the Rings, where they have just these long, drawn out and crying and staring into each other's eyes. I understand that this is just typical film stuff, but this is why I don't watch a lot of fiction. I mostly watch nonfiction and read nonfiction. So,
see, but I love media that makes me feel something. So I don't mind that. If they're crying and it's appropriate for them to be crying in that moment, I'm all for it.
Oh, yes. And I do agree with that. This is just a personal preference of mine. There was some quote I heard this week where a scholar was saying, you cannot manufacture the spirit, right? You can't stage manage the spirit and whether it is going to be there, and that emotional experiences don't bring the spirit. The spirit brings emotional experiences. So maybe that's a little bit of a distinction without a difference when you're talking about filming, but I prefer things where I feel like I've had an emotional epiphany rather than I'm being dragged into misery by the machinations of the director. And that's because I just sympathize so much with the characters that I always end up crying, and I hate it. It ruins the experience for me.
That is a great line that I am going to steal in the future about the relationship between emotions and crying and the spirit and which comes before the other, being manipulated into it. But we Latter-day Saints have a long tradition of that sort of.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Seminary videos.
Girls camp.
Yep. But we'll move on from that to our final rating, which is for Gospel Connections, Morally Edifying Messages. I think nothing earns a 5 if this doesn't earn a 5.
5, 5, 5. I would feel comfortable using clips from this series in my Sunday school class that I teach.
Yeah. I usually, this is an ongoing thing for me, is I, even if they're really good messages, I always want to give it 4 apricots, unless there's an explicit gospel connection, and it's a show about Jesus and the disciples. So, yep, check. We checked that box. 5 apricots for me.
Mary Jane, where can people find your poetry? I really enjoyed the one you read, and if people want to hear more, where can they find you?
I have a website, maryjanerice.com. Let me spell my name because it's a little weird. That's MerriJaneRice.com.
And we can put a link in the show notes too for people to...
I have 2 published books. One is Messages on the Water, which is general poems, and the other is Grace Like Water, which is New Testament poems. You can get those both on Amazon.com and just about any other online bookstore that you can find. In the future, I will be publishing this fall, Out of the Dust, which is Book of Mormon Poems. And then in the 2 following years, I'll publish more. But all of that will be on my website, maryjanerice.com.
And you also have a podcast where you read them weekly. Tell us about that.
It's called Follow, Latter-day Saint Scripture Poetry Podcast. That's only available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, but you can also listen to it on my website. And I do have a Facebook page also called Follow.
I've been listening to those. And so if you enjoyed Mary Jane talking about how she goes from the scriptures into a poem, she explains a little bit about how she writes each poem. And it's really interesting.
And it's short. It's under 10 minutes.
Under 10 minutes once a week. It's a great way to supplement your Come Follow Me. I love it. Dallin, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on my website, dallincrump.com. It's just my blog. I write random things, and you can find links to my social media and contact info on there.
All right. And Carl?
I'm on Twitter at Carl Cranny. They're fighting the good fight sometimes and just posting some nonsense at other times.
And you can follow my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com and find my social media on there. Thanks for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a like or review and share the podcast with someone who you know will love it. Carl, can you tell us what we'll be talking about on our next episode?
Yes. In our next episode, we will be doing a comparison of 2 recent Pinocchio films. The first is Disney's live-action remake of their animated classic, which is available on Disney Plus and came out last September. And the second is Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which is available on Netflix and came out just last December. So since they both came out really in close proximity to each other, we're interested to see who did a better job with this classic story and compare and contrast them with each other. So be ready for that conversation next time, I think, which will resonate a little bit with this conversation with your example of Cinderella stories and things like that. So be ready for that in our next episode.
All right. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.